For the week of December 3rd, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 391, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York at the Macy's store, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you at the Macy's store? Or are you?
I'm trying to find you a gift for Christmas and I just don't know what to get you.
I don't think Macy's sells world peace.
No, they don't.
Yeah. Yeah,
they don't even sell what I know you really want and what I want for Christmas, too. And it's not an Instant Pot. It's for our listeners to take a moment right now and vote on the show. Give us 5 stars on iTunes. Just we'll wait for you. Get your shopping done now. We'll wait for you. We'll just talk amongst ourselves while you guys do that.
Well, you could also do it on the Google Play Store.
No. iTunes.
Okay, Michael is prejudiced against apparently all the other podcast aggregators, but feel free to. And you know what? You can find all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. It's where you'll find ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You'll find ways to follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. You can even call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. We have totally reversed the order of this show.
That's right. And we're about to hit episode number 400. My friend is about to hit episode 20 of his podcast, and he has twice as many as reviews as we do.
Well,
more than doubled the reviews that we do.
He's a political podcast, though, correct?
Yes.
Okay. We're not going to mention the name of it because we don't want any more reviews for that particular.
Yes. Don't mention NPR. They might get more listeners. Yes. So if he's listening and the people who have now come back from rating and reviewing the show on iTunes, they've come back, they're ready for our podcast. What will they hear about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, it's Grammy time, and the nominations are out with Jay-Z and Kendrick Lamar, the frontrunners for Album of the Year. Joining us this week is Steve Knopper, a contributing editor for Rolling Stone and author of several books about the music industry, including MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson. He'll explain how musicians have taken a lesson from Hollywood and begun mounting campaigns to snag music's highest honor. On Inside Baseball, well, what else are people talking about? Sexual misconduct, we'll have the latest. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to...
Hey, what about Book Filter? What's happened to Book Filter? How come we don't talk about the...
You're Mr. Book Filter, okay? And I noticed that all of a sudden it was dropped from the show. I wasn't going to say anything because I've noticed that Book Filter continues to be updated. It's where I get all of my latest reads. And yet... it somehow disappeared from Showbiz Sandbox.
But the fact is, to explain, some people have reached out, they've called, they've texted, the way Sperling described before. From Thanksgiving through New Year, no books come out.
Yes, it's weird.
They want all the books in the... No, it's not. They want all the books in the store by Black Friday. So by Black Friday, all the big fall releases, all the big books of the year are in the stores. 99.9% of the books. They've come out weeks or months before, or at the very latest, they come out by then, so that for that last 5 to 6 weeks of shopping, or 4 weeks before Christmas, all the books are there. So anytime you happen to go to the mall or pass by a bookstore, the books they want on display are in the window and they can catch your eye and you can come in and buy them, which means after Thanksgiving, after Black Friday, almost nothing comes out. Books that come out by the thousands, the tens of thousands every week of the year, like 4 come out now. So right now, when I'm looking at the best cookbooks of the week, I'm looking at like 7 books and I'm going, oh, I don't know that one. So there's just not much coming out right now. And that's why we're not covering them. But we will start covering them again next year when books start to flood back into the stores come January. Until then, we'll just go keep seeing the movies.
Well, you know, just to prove how improvised our show really is, if I had known you were going to mention Book Filter, during our intro here, I would have found out the episode of the show where you recommended The Power. Do you remember that book that you recommended?
Yes, that's right. It's a book about young women suddenly get superpowers and the whole world freaks out.
Right. It's like the reverse, you know, all of a sudden women are on top and men have to struggle. And I finally finished that book. I say that as if it took me weeks to read. It actually took a week to read. It's a good book. Naomi Alderman, it's worth reading. So thank you for pointing that out to me.
And hasn't it been optioned?
I am sure as I was reading it, I just thought, yeah, this is a movie. Whoever wrote they wrote it as a movie.
I think it was in the news last week for being optioned.
Yeah, that makes sense. But you know, when it does turn into a movie or is adapted into a major motion picture, I'm sure it will wind up in the top 10 box office wise. And indeed, we always turn it over to you first, Michael, entertainment journalist extraordinaire. You always fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Maybe we shouldn't improv so much.
No,
we're looking at the
not
box office. We're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to Comscore in our show notes. And the number one movie around the world is Pixar Disney's Coco, perhaps the last film John Lasseter will oversee as head of Disney Animation. It grossed $95 million worldwide. It's at $280 million and counting. It doubled its gross in China from last week. It opened last week in China. This week it doubled its gross. So that's pretty exciting. It's the highest grossing movie of all time in animation in Mexico. It's got 40% of the worldwide market to go. That will come out after the new year. So it's in 60% of worldwide markets right now, another 40% to come. So there's a long way to go. But what's really fascinating about this movie is that they have yanked the short that plays in front of Coco. It's called Olaf's Frozen Adventures, and it is god-awful.
Well, you know, if I had known that the short was 22 minutes long, first of all, that's not a short, okay? I know it's a short, but, you know, for a movie that is geared towards children to have 20 minutes of previews and then a 22-minute short, that's 40 minutes that they have to sit through before the feature film even starts.
Right, that's what their explanation for why they have pulled it. But I think the further explanation is that it is god-awful bad. It is truly dreadful. It is an awful, awful short. Our in-house critic, Aaron, saw it and said, oh my God, the short is dreadful. It's terrible. And I thought, well, right, whatever. He hates everything. It can't be that, you know. And oh my God, it's dreadful. And all my guests thought, oh my God, that is dreadful. It is really, and not only is it not helping promote the next Frozen movie, it's practically negatively from people going, gee, I don't know if I want to see Frozen 2. They said, if it's that bad, I'm not going to go. I mean, it was really lame on every level. It was really incompetent, truly.
So you saw it?
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely awful. Yeah, it's a terrible, terrible 21-minute short. It is one of the worst. They've had bad shorts before, like the one with the volcano. Usually they're not that long. Sometimes they're good. They're sort of training grounds for new directors. This one is one of their most valuable property right now. Frozen is coming to Broadway. There's a new film coming out in 2019. And this short should be, you know, a jewel destined to make people go, oh my God, I can't wait to see Frozen on Broadway. I can't wait to see Frozen 2 when it comes into theaters a year from now. And instead, it makes you hate it.
Well, you know, part of what those shorts are for Pixar are not only training grounds for new directors, but they also try out technology. So they'll be trying out, well, gee, how does this skin wrapping work? Or how about these, there was one where they were testing out hair, and then that turned into, of course, Monsters, Inc. Sully's hair, they needed to test out first.
Yes, sure they do. I don't think any of that is the issue here. I think it was just poorly written, poorly directed. It was just not good. It's directed by Kevin Dieters and Stevie Wormers, written by Chris Buck and Jennifer Lee and Jack Schaefer. And bad, bad story done all around. Bad songs, bad story. It really didn't look good either. Maybe they were trying something new because I actually thought the characters didn't look very good. So,
well, you know, it's funny because I was going to run out and try and see Coco before it disappeared from that particular short disappeared from theaters. Now I might not run so fast.
Well, it's gone. They've yanked it.
No, December 8th.
Oh, so, well, you know, it's good to see how bad it is, you know, if you want to be on top of things. That's the number one movie around the world. Happily, some people found out that the short was there and they knew they could arrive 40 minutes late. Now they can be able to fit in an extra screening of Coco a day because they've yanked the short. I mean, you add that up, four screenings a day, that's another film showing. That's how dumb that is. That's really a bad calculation on every level. Anyway, $280 million worldwide for Coco. We'll rush through the rest of these. That took forever. Justice League, $52 million on the weekend, $570 million worldwide. It's certainly slowing down. It's not going to catch up to Thor Ragnarok. We'll have to see where it ends up. But if it gets to 750 or 800, it will not be a disaster, though clearly being the lowest grossing DC Universe film is pretty awful news since this is supposed to be the one that everybody gets amped up about. At number three around the world is Murder on the Orient Express, $30 million on the weekend, $240 million worldwide. That's a huge success for Kenneth Branagh. At number four, Daddy's Home 2, $23 million on the weekend, $115 million worldwide. here's a really good success story. Just like Coco and Murder on the Orient Express, we've got Wonder, the family film that's huge in North America, $20 million on the weekend and $100 million worldwide. It's not even close to being done. At number six is Thor Ragnarok, the superhero movie that people actually enjoy right now, $16 million on the weekend, $816 million worldwide. And number seven, here's a new film we haven't talked about yet. It's Fireworks. Should we see it from the side or the bottom? It's a Japanese animated film, which is a remake of a live-action TV movie about young people watching fireworks, you know, around high school. And it's a day in the life of the kids. The school beauty gets a boy to run away from her. They're watching the fireworks. And apparently, there's sort of a Groundhog Day twist where the day keeps repeating and different things happen based on what people do. I think that's how I understood it. It's made $10 million on the weekend. It's at $26 million worldwide. So it either opened up on Wednesday or we missed it last weekend. And number eight is A Bad Mom's Christmas. That passed the $100 million mark. Number nine is Paddington 2. That's about to hit $50 million. And number 10, the Korean heist film The Swindlers. That's at $18 million worldwide. And then number 11 and 12 are some Oscar hopefuls. There's Lady Bird and then Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Both made about $4 million. Lady Bird is at $17 million worldwide. And Three Billboards is at $13 million. And every step of the way, it looks like Lady Bird is outpacing Three Billboards. I say this, but it's not a competition except for the actual award. As far as both movies, they're both going to be commercial and critical success stories, so they can both be very happy. They'll both probably be nominated for Best Picture, certainly for Best Actress, you know, but Lady Bird seems to be the one that really is getting the most momentum from award season and even doing better at the box office.
Yes, and indeed, it's doing better on Rotten Tomatoes. Not that that means anything, according to IndieWire here. Lady Bird is now the highest or best reviewed movie of all time on Rotten Tomatoes. The previous record holder, Toy Story 3, had a 100% tomato meter mark or whatever, you know, the grading is there, but with 163 reviews, whereas Lady Bird has a 100% score with 165 reviews.
But that's stupid. Why are we even repeating that? Because that could be everybody saying that the movie's okay, and they could all be saying Toy Story 3 is a masterpiece and Lady Bird is okay, and they could both have 100%.
And that's why I said that, so that you could point that out.
But why would we mention it? We should stop mentioning it because it's misleading and dumb. At number 13 is Furious, a Russian period flick about a knight fighting back against the occupying Mongol Empire. The score of this Russian film is by Serge Tankian of System of a Down. That's sort of interesting. It opened to $4 million in two territories, one of which I assume is Russia, and the other one of which I assume will soon be Russia once again after they invade. At number 14, sorry, Russians who like Vladimir Putin. At number 14 is Kill Me, Please, a Brazilian film, I believe, about teens consumed with dread and ennui over a wave of killings in their neighborhood. This is what I think this movie is. It grossed $4 million on the weekend. I'm not quite sure if I have the right film nailed down. If I've got it wrong and you know what the deal is, let us know. We've already told you how. The star is making about $27 million. That's the animated nativity film. We'll have to see if it really shows some legs here in the U.S. Here's an interesting new movie. At number 16, it's a Japanese live-action film. It's called Full Metal Alchemist. And I mentioned the fact that it's live-action because it's a version of a manga, which is about two brothers dabbling in alchemy. One almost dies. The other gets turned into half machine. And they're searching for the Philosopher's Stone, that famed relic that can help make them whole again. And it's already been a manga, which was turned into two TV shows, two anime movies, video games, collectibles, more. This is a huge, huge property in Japan. And now it's become a live action film. And it's opened, I think, pretty modestly at $3.6 million. At number 17 is Forgotten, a South Korean thriller. This is about a man who was kidnapped for 19 days. He's been released, and he can't remember anything about what happened, and his brother is determined to find out why. $3.4 million is what it's made. Jigsaw the Horror Flick is just about to hit $100 million. That will happen by next weekend. Happy Death Day is ahead of it at about $110 million. Here's another new film. I think it's an Italian film. It's called Perfect Strangers. This sounds like the worst idea in the world to do in real life. It grossed $2 million and is about a group of friends getting together, seven different friends. They get together at dinner. They put their cell phones in the middle of the table, as people sometimes will, to say, no cell phones. We're all just going to be talking. But no, they say, let's play a game. Let's all reveal every single text and phone call we get during dinner because we have nothing to hide.
This is such a bad idea.
Who would do that in real life? I would be like, I have to go. Sorry, that's ridiculous. I'm not doing that.
I just got a text. I've got to go.
Yeah, marriages will end. Are you people high? I mean, that's just a very dumb idea. Why anyone would do it? It must have been a lot of wine. At number 21 is Our Happiness, another film I am scratching my head over. A lot of movies this week that we were lost on. This movie grossed $2 million. I tried to track it down, but it's got such a generic sort of title that I wasn't able to figure out exactly what it was. So we've got Our Happiness, Perfect Strangers. What was some of the others we were giving? Kill Me, Please. If you are sure of what these films are, you know, do let us know, because we'd love to find out exactly what they are, what they're about, how they're doing, what their budget is, all that sort of stuff.
That's right. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com or 888-567-SAND, 888-567-7263.
That's right. Two other Oscar hopefuls, at least for Best Actor, one of which probably isn't going to happen. That's Denzel Washington in Roman J. Israel Esquire, followed right below by Gary Oldman as Churchill. He is Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour. Roman J. Israel Esquire is in pretty wide release in North America, and it grossed $2 million on the week, and it's about to hit $10 million. Completely credible to Denzel Washington. That's the only reason this movie is making any money. Darkest Hour by Gary Oldman is still in limited release, and it's made about $2 million so far.
Have you seen the commercials for this film? It just looks like Gary Oldman just chewing on the scenery, just like...
I saw the movie.
Oh, okay. And?
It's just like every other, you know, it's set around the time period of Dunkirk. And it's not really about Dunkirk or they're making any decisions about that. It's about Winston Churchill coming to power and how that sort of happened almost accidentally and nobody wanted it. And he had doubts about what to do and how to behave when we're shown historically, no, Winston Churchill always knew what to say and do. Here you see him struggling and confused and not sure how to behave. But it really pales in comparison to Dunkirk, even though they're very different stories. And you just feel like, yeah. You know, you've seen Churchill 1,000 times. Coleman does a perfectly fine job, but it feels very PS, if you know what I mean. You know,
okay.
See Dunkirk, and then maybe if you want to, you can see this. And right below that is Viking, a Russian historical epic. It opened in China and made $1.7 million on the weekend. So far, it's at $27, $28 million worldwide. So it's a big opening in China. It's not just Hollywood movies that want to open there. It's every big movie around the world, whether it's France or Russia or Japan. They all want to open in China because pretty soon that's going to be the biggest film market in the world.
But will they have a national board of review to tell all of the many 1.4 billion citizens what films they should see?
They will. It's called the government paper. National Board of Review and the New York Times and the New York Film Critics and the LA Film Critics have all weighed in. Who did the National Board of Review say was the best film of the year?
The Post, Steven Spielberg.
That's right. That's the timely story of journalism bringing down a president. Is it about Watergate?
I don't know. You know, I have to say, I don't know. I don't think it is about Watergate.
Not per se, I guess not. But it is getting some good buzz. A friend of mine saw it, said he thinks it's one of the best films of the year, thinks it's his best in a while. You know, I'm certainly looking forward to checking it out with Meryl Streep in a top role. The other big films are The Usual Suspects, by and large. Baby Driver, Call Me By Your Name, The Disaster Artist, Downsizing, Dunkirk, The Florida Project, Get Out, Lady Bird, Logan, and Phantom Thread. Now, they don't waste any space here. They also have 10 of the best independent films, if they're not on that top list. They also list 5 foreign films, 5 documentaries. I mean, they list like 30 films. So they're like, here are all the good movies of the year, just to make sure you've seen them all. But the New York Film Critics, they don't mess around. They pick one movie as the best film of the year. Who won?
Lady Bird.
All right. How else? Who else were the big winners?
Well, Sean Baker for The Florida Project. They kind of spread the love around. Okay. So they liked Sean Baker's The Florida Project, as did I. And Best Actor went to Timothy, is it Chalamet?
I think it's Chalamet.
Yeah. Call Me By Your Name. Best Actress, Saoirse Ronan. I should know how to pronounce that name after this week's Saturday Night Live. Lady Bird is what she starred in. I don't know if you want to go down supporting actors.
I think basically Lady Bird was the big winner with, you know, Best Picture and Best Actress. And then the Florida Project got Best Director and Best Supporting Actor. So you can see, you know, some momentum there going for them. Animated film is Coco. Most people seem to be saying that. Agnes Varda's Faces Places is getting a lot of love as Best Documentary or Nonfiction Film. And Coco is a lot of people's pick for Best Animated Film. But the L.A. film critics disagreed. The New York film critics said Lady Bird. The L.A. film critics said Call Me By Your Name. That was their favorite film of the year, with runner-up being The Florida Project. Best Director was a tie, Call Me By Your Name and The Shape of Water. And then again, Best Actor, Timothée Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name. He's getting a lot of momentum. Sally Hawkins for her first big nomination or win. That's for The Shape of Water, the Guillermo del Toro film about a woman in love with a fish.
You know, once I stumbled over Timothée Chalamet's name, you know he's going to win the Oscar this year, and everybody will know his name from now on.
That's right. They'll call him by his name.
Right. Oh, that's a good one. I didn't even see that.
Thank you very much. Armie Hammer is, of course, his co-star in that film, and he's just announced he's coming to Broadway. He's been in Call Me By Your Name, and now he's, just to make sure they know, he's going to star on Broadway in Straight White Men. Which sounds like an overreaction to being in a film where he's in love with a younger man, but it's not. It's a play from several years ago by young Jean Lee, one of the most notable young playwrights in America today. She will be the first Asian woman to have a play on Broadway ever. I saw the play a few years ago. I really didn't think much of it. I'm surprised it's coming to Broadway, but it's because there's a new Broadway house owned by Second Stage Theater Company, and they're known for remounting shows. That's their entire purpose. Shows that were mounted and perhaps didn't get quite the attention or love, or weren't done as successful as they could be, they get a second staging by this theater company. So this play is right up their alley. It's an important playwright, young Jean Lee. They're going to have some big names attached, and they'll be able to make the economics work so they can bring it to Broadway and give the show another chance.
And you know what I've noticed about plays these days? They're actually traveling overseas, which is a good thing. This is not a complaint, but I've noticed a lot of the plays that I'll see, plays like the one you just mentioned, will actually, they'll start out maybe in Los Angeles or Boston or Washington. They'll make their way to New York, where they get an off-Broadway or even, you know, a Broadway debut. It's usually short run, you know, it's not a long run. And then they make their way to Sweden and Switzerland and Germany and the UK, and then sometimes to Australia. And I haven't seen Asia. I have to say, I haven't seen, you know, some of these plays, and I don't mean musicals, I mean plays. I don't see them going to Asia. That just might be me, an oversight on my part.
Yeah, I don't know. Certainly musicals are the most popular export. I think plays have always traveled all over the world, but perhaps you're spotting something I haven't really caught on to yet. Certainly, I know that in South Korea, they have just mounted a new production of Titanic, which is sort of an immersive surround, the audience is around the stage. So the ship is like in the middle of the room and the audience is seated all around. So the chorus and the orchestra and everybody is just all around you. And so that's sort of an interesting, exciting staging of the musical Titanic, which was a Best Tony winner. It was a very good show, actually. And I'm kind of looking forward to this production. It too is eyeing coming to Broadway. So that'd be a fun case where a show comes to Broadway, goes to Korea, gets a new staging, and then comes back to Broadway again.
Yeah, I like this trend of like having to rebuild entire theaters for musical productions.
Well, unfortunately, virtually no Broadway house is prepared for that. They had to really spend a ton of money to do it for The Great Comet. I really wish there were one or two new Broadway houses being built that were, in fact, you know, empty shells that you could just reformat and do whatever you want every time a show came in, because that is a big... That is a long-standing trend, not even a trend. It's just a long-standing need to be able to put shows in new configurations, not just the proscenium stage.
Yeah, you know, speaking of new configurations, we have this kind of unofficial segment every week now that seems to be like This Week in Reboot Sequels and Spinoffs. And you put in a story here that I had copied and pasted into our show notes, and I was about to paste it in, and I went, oh, it's already here. And that was the Jersey Shore is being revived by MTV with the original cast.
Good God. And they say it's only been 5 years. I would have sworn it was like 10 or 15 years ago.
I think we're just trying to bury it in our mind.
Yeah, exactly. Jersey Shore. That's a sure sign of desperation on MTV's part. They've had the Jersey Shore Family Vacation is the idea of the new thing. They had a reunion show or series somewhere on some other channel. The idea that they're going to bring that back and it's going to somehow spark up audiences for MTV again is really wishful thinking.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, it might get one of those like curiosity looks for the first 3 weeks, and then, you know, people will make fun of it for the fourth and fifth week, and then nobody will look at it again. That's my prediction.
Well, that's what happens with Grammy nominations. They come out, and then people fight over and argue over, then they win, and then we forget what happened next week. But we always remember the winners, don't we?
That's true. Like last year when, who won last year?
Yeah, I don't know.
I honestly can't remember. I think it was Adele, actually, wasn't it?
Of course it was Adele. What, are you crazy?
Okay.
She beat out Beyonce's Lemonade, and yeah. Now Beyonce's husband, Jay-Z, is going to get his revenge.
Well, that's the plan. Yeah, I mean, unlike last year where the Grammys were faulted, really, for kind of playing it safe by going with Adele over Beyonce, it looks like the Grammys are kind of, you know, trying to stay relevant by nominating, I think, how many hip-hop artists are nominated this year? It seems a ton of them. And meanwhile, you got Ed Sheeran and Harry Styles kind of out of the loop.
Yeah, I don't think you can criticize the Grammys for giving Album of the Year to the biggest album of the year. Critical and commercials, massive success, massive worldwide too. Adele's the biggest star in the world by some measures. So I don't think you can say, oh, that's crazy of them to give it to that. It's like saying they're crazy for giving the Oscar for Best Picture to Titanic. Sure, it's not the best film of the year, but it's hardly a nutty thing to do when you're celebrating your own industry.
Yeah, and I always think that, you know, certainly this is what the media is talking about. Oh, look, all these hip-hop artists, they're trying to, you know, be hip, no pun intended. But I would say, no, like you, Michael, these are popular albums. These are the albums selling the most, okay? And if you look back, the Grammys have always been faulted for playing, as you say, a popularity contest. They may have voted for what was popular over what was good.
Well, again, being the highest grossing album of the year doesn't mean you're going to win the album of
the year. No, not at all.
You know, every couple of years, though, it just becomes inevitable. It's such a big film like Gone with the Wind or Titanic or whatever that it becomes feels sort of inevitable. Sometimes that happens with the Grammys. You knew Thriller was going to win. You knew Adele was going to win. You know, it happens sometimes. But this year, the story is certainly that the nominating committees have done their job. If you think the Grammys should be a little cooler and reflect the music people are actually listening to, hip hop and rap have dominated the charts for like 20 years now. This is not, you know, the fact that rock is not on the album of the year list or country. Well, that's where the action is. So the albums of the year are Childish Gambino by Donald Glover. Good God, his album persona is Childish Gambino. The album is called Awaken My Love. What a year for Donald Glover, who also has the TV show Atlanta. That's followed by Jay-Z with his album, or sort of response album to Beyonce's Lemonade. Kendrick Lamar with Damn. Lord with Melodrama, the lone woman and the lone non-hip-hop album or non-rap R&B hip-hop album. And then filling out the top five, Bruno Mars with 24 Karat Magic.
You know, actually, when I was on that boat, you know, the cruise, the Thanksgiving cruise that I was on a week or two ago, and the whole children's karaoke, some like 9-year-old went up on stage and sang that song 24 Karat Magic, which I did not realize had so many curse words in it. But apparently all the parents went ballistic and thought it was hilarious.
You adults just love it when kids curse, don't you?
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah. It's not that exciting. So, yeah, to me, the outliers here are the Bruno Mars album, which is not good. It's not good as his last album. It's not a great album. And Childish Gambino. It's, you know, to me, those feel like, huh? So I could have easily seen some other albums get into those slots, but that's what the Album of the Year award is for. You go, why is that on there? And this should win, not that. You know, will it be Jay-Z or Kendrick Lamar? I don't know. I thought Kendrick Lamar's album was not as good as his last album. I thought his last album was far superior. Of the five, I would vote for Lorde's Melodrama, but she got almost no other nominations. So it's highly unlikely she will triumph for Album of the Year. It does look like the one that's not like the others, which means you could split the hip-hop vote between Jay-Z and Kendrick Lamar. People who want more fun poppy dance music might go for Childish Gambino or Bruno Mars, and Lorde sneaks in there. But I think that's getting too cute and clever. People don't really vote that way. She got almost no nominations other than Album of the Year. So I'm assuming, like most people, it will come down to Jay-Z or Kendrick Lamar.
Well, what about Record of the Year? You've got Redbone by Childish Gambino, Despacito by Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee featuring Justin Bieber, The Story of OJ from Jay-Z, Kendrick Lamar's Humble, and Bruno Mars' 24 Karat Magic, that song with all the profane words in it.
Well, to me, Despacito is clearly the record of the year. I wouldn't give it song of the year because I don't think a lot of other people are going to cover it down the road. But that's silly, right? Justin Bieber covered it before it has even finished being on the charts, and he got added into the song at the last minute. So I imagine that song will sweep song and record of the year. You know, that's just what will happen. We're going down through the charts. If you look, there's always some crazy, nutty nomination where you go, how did that artist get in that category? Like Jethro Tull for Best Heavy Metal Album. This year, it's under the Best Folk Album. You have Cat Stevens, The Secret Sisters, Laura Marling, Ofer Rex, sure, and Amy Mann. What the hell is Amy Mann's mental illness doing in Best Folk Album? That's insane.
What do you mean? I mean, I guess she, yeah. I guess
it's not a folk album. She's a rock person, maybe pop, but she is not folk. In no way, shape, or form is Amy Mann a folk artist. That's just crazy.
Well, do you think a Best Americana album just goes to Greg Allman because he passed away?
Absolutely not. No.
Okay.
The best album on there is Jason Isbell's The Nashville Sound, which should be up for Best Country Album. Certainly Greg Allman could win. Any of them could win, but I would imagine it's down to him and Jason Isbell. I actually like the Mavericks album too, but The Nashville Sound is far and away the best album in that list, so I hope he wins. And when you look at country album, he should be fighting it out with Chris Stapleton, who's From a Room Volume 1 is one of the best albums of the year. And now Volume 2 has just come out. That will be eligible next year. That's getting great reviews too. And that should keep his name prominent in the eyes of Grammy voters as they're voting for best country album. They know, hey, he just has a new album. He has Volume 2 out. And that should really help him. So that timing is actually excellent for trying to win a Grammy nomination.
Well, speaking of trying to win Grammy nominations, Michael, that's actually a good lead-in for our discussion with Steve Knopper, a Rolling Stone contributing editor and author of MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson, and Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Business in the Digital Age. And if anybody knows anything about me, they know that book is now on my holiday reading list. Steve, thank you for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So, Steve, I love Oscar campaigns, and I have never really thought about the Grammy Awards and if and how people campaign for them. And I'm assuming that in the past, mostly campaigning for a Grammy Award meant taking an ad out in Billboard. Was that sort of the extent of it?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the case, and it's still the case today, really.
And in Hollywood, there's always been a lot of block voting. When you were working for MGM, they damn well expected you to vote for the MGM's big movie that year come Oscar time. Is there the same sense of loyalty in the record industry where because you work for, whatever record label, you feel like, oh, yeah, you got to support your company's guy?
I mean, that's possible. That my story didn't really get into that. No, certainly no one admitted that to me. But I'm sure that kind of thing does go on in the music business. But on the other hand, I mean, record labels have diminishing importance, as you know, these days. You know, 15, yeah. 20 years ago or earlier, there was a lot of power that they could have because nobody could release music without the label's permission or resources. And now certainly there's other things you can do.
Well, now, let me ask, your story, which ran in Rolling Stone, was about how, you know, these artists are actually mounting tactical campaigns, these marketing campaigns, meant to drive not only Grammy nominations, but Grammy wins. And that's because albums aren't selling as much anymore based solely on the music.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, there's these two Grammy voting periods that happen, and everyone knows when they are. There's one, I believe, in, October, which is for the nominations. It's something like 2 or 3 week period. And then there's another one that's happening now, which will determine the final votes. And so what smart record labels and management companies and any other reps for artists, publicists, and everybody else do is they just say, well, we're going to do our marketing and publicity blitz during this time. So, for example, the big example I used in the article was Harry Styles went on CBS This Morning on October 14th and sort of dutifully gave the interview about how great it was to be in a boy band and, you know, all that stuff. Well, you know, the very next day is when the voting period begins for the Grammy nominations. So no, probably no real coincidence there in the timing.
And you point out that he had nothing to promote. It's not like he was on tour anymore. Certainly he was promoting the album, which is kind of an ongoing effort. But he wasn't saying, hey, I just happen to be in town to play at Madison Square Garden. No, he actually went on with that particular goal in mind, although it was unspoken by everyone.
Right. No, that's the assumption that people made. I mean, honestly, I did not talk to the Harry Styles people about that. I talked to numerous other sources who are all basically speculating that that's what the timing was for this.
Well, let me ask you something. Something you point out in the article is that who votes for Grammys? It changes from year to year. I did not know that. I always thought, well, no, it's the Recording Academy, and once you get in, just like the Oscars, you always get to vote. But what are the qualifications for voting for the Grammys each year?
Yeah, you're testing my memory a little bit because it does change every year, but it's you have to have some sort of participation in, I think it's at least 6 tracks that are available commercially over the course of the most recent Grammy voting period, which is 1 year. So if you're a producer, if you've contributed album artwork, certainly if you're a musician, all of those people are eligible to be Grammy voters. And I think it winds up being, I think the number is something like 12,000.
So if you're literally a graphic designer, you could wind up voting for Grammys.
Sure. Yeah, you could. And I can't get into, I mean, I'm not prepared enough to be able to tell you all the nuances of Grammy voting, but there is something about sort of, you can vote in your own category, which, you know, if you're a bluegrass musician, then you vote for the bluegrass category or the blues category or whatever it is.
Right.
Plus you get to vote in the 5 major categories, which are Album of the Year and Song of the Year and New Artist and so forth.
And that's just like the Oscars, where you vote in your area, like cinematography, and then you vote for the big ones like Best Picture and so on. And then you get to vote once the nominations are out. Everybody can vote for every category. But it's kind of fun because in the Oscars, the people who pay a lot of attention and get to vote early on, when you have sort of the committees, like in charge of foreign films or animated films, or even the people just voting in their craft area like cinematography, they tend to people who are maybe more retired, aren't so busy. But in Grammys, you're actually actively busy, maybe have less time to vote. And in fact, that's when they let you vote. Like, you've got albums out, you've got songs out right now. You may be on the road. You may be too busy to vote, but that's when you actually are eligible to do so.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And there's other issues too. You know, there's sort of like, you know, the people who are, and this is, I think, true with the Oscars too, but the people who are most active in the Grammys and the Recording Academy and are paying close attention and listening to all the stuff are people who are sort of sitting at home, tending to be, you know, people who perhaps musicians or people in the industry who are older. Whereas, you know, your hip hop musicians, your current modern day stars are out there touring and doing stuff and may not have as much of a chance. So you're suddenly asking people who are not quite the demographic of the people who are listening to all the Album of the Year categories, who are being sort of asked to decide this stuff. The Grammys do have one other thing, though, which I'm not sure the Oscars do, which is this thing that people have kind of nicknamed the Black Box Committee. So after all the votes are being taken, there's this mysterious committee that meets. I don't know how many people are on it. I don't know who's on it. But they sort of like weed out the bad decisions to make sure that Jethro Tull doesn't win Best Metal Artist, which was, you know, the infamous debacle that happened in the early 90s. They sort of weed everything out to make sure that something ridiculous hasn't happened.
So it's like an electoral college, but for the Grammys.
Right. A little bit. Yeah. I mean, a little bit. It's more like a shady, well, I wouldn't say shady, but it's more like a smoke-filled room where everybody's sitting down and going, yeah, we can't have this.
So it's the room where it happens. I've got a million of these. I could keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I don't understand is why that Black Box Committee didn't say maybe Amy Mann doesn't belong in the Best Folk Album category. But anyway, right. There's always a head scratcher every year. But if you look at the Oscars, there's always some big campaign that works really well and wakes everybody else up to the new possibilities of what they should be doing, whether it's having parties or having interviews where they invite people to screen the movie and then the cast shows up on stage to sort of hobnob and rub elbows. Is there a big recent campaign for Grammys that people went, yeah, that worked really well, we should be doing that?
Recently, you know, I can't really point to anything. I mean, the example that somebody gave me, you know, you mentioned Amy Winehouse and back when she was alive, you know, she was sort of being, promoted as a Grammy artist and her people did a campaign. I'm trying to remember what year this was. It was like the year before her death when she won a whole bunch of Grammys. And she had, as you probably remember, a whole bunch of problems with the paparazzi. You know, she kind of like had drug problems and boyfriend problems and all this horrible stuff was happening. And so her people kind of used this Grammy campaign to kind of rehabilitate her image and promote her for a Grammy Award, saying, hey, despite all this bad publicity she's been getting, remember, she's still one of the greatest artists that we have, the best singer who's out there. And it worked. And sure enough, she won a whole bunch of Grammys that year.
Can you talk a little bit about these third party, I guess, assistants in regards to these email lists and these private Facebook groups or these secret Facebook groups? I was, first of all, surprised that there are secret Facebook groups. I thought they were all, you could kind of see all of the groups. You may not be let into them, but you can see all of them. But there are these groups out there where people are campaigning in Facebook groups and on email lists.
Yeah, I mean, there is a Facebook group that's out there. I'm not privy to it. I was not invited to it. But there's also the Grammy Pro page, and I did get some temporary access to that and was able to look around. And it's just basically people kind of promoting their music. The Grammy Pro thing is very straightforward. There's a whole bunch of rules. You know, you can't spend all your time promoting. You can only post music in certain areas of the message board and stuff like that. So people are constantly doing that. So it's just a way that people kind of communicate with other voting members. And then, you know, one thing I did get into in pretty great depth in the article is that there are companies out there that will charge you for like a Grammy email blast. And so like one of the ones I talked to is called Bongo Boy Records. And that's run by a couple of people who are musicians who actually are Grammy voters themselves. So they have access to all these, you know, groups and Grammy Pro and all this other stuff. And so what they do is they network and they get people's emails and people's contact information, and they compile this list. I forget what they said, but it's something like 2,000 or 3,000 names at least. And then they charge you if you're an artist who wants to get your name in front of the most voters. They'll charge you something like $165 for the first blast and $100 for the second blast, something like that. It's, you know, is it effective? I don't know. They point to some of the success stories that they've had. You know, a lot of Grammy voters get a bunch of crap in their emails. So, you know, I'm not sure that it's like the fail-safe way to get yourself a Grammy award.
It sounds like one of the things that the Grammys will probably try and shut down or you know, hold back on. I mean, the Oscars, they say don't give away expensive goodie bags, and they may say, hey, members can't use emails to reach out to other members to campaign and charge for it. It sounds like something that they might be able to crack down on.
It's possible, but then they'd have to crack down. You know, I'm a music writer, and I get emails all the time for your consideration. You know, Island Def Jam, don't forget about these artists. You know, I'm not a voter.
But they're not being paid to do that. They're promoting themselves, right?
Yeah, sure. But so you know, this has been going on 4, 5, 6 years, and at least, and I don't get the sense that they're violating any of the Grammy rules, at least at this point.
Do we see acts having lots of cool personal showcases in New York and L.A. during these two voting periods where they want to have people maybe have a chance to come see them or just get buzz or get written about and just sort of raise their visibility?
That does happen from time to time. You know, one of the examples I use in the article is Fantastic Negrito, who's a yes. blues singer and has a really interesting backstory. And he wound up earlier this year, so the 2017 Grammy Awards, winning, I think it was the best traditional blues album. It might have been contemporary. I can't remember. But, you know, he was on tour anyway and just made a point of every place he went, his manager would sort of make sure that they would stay in touch with the local Grammy chapter and go to an event and sort of, you know, market themselves really pointedly to that chapter. I think they did that. I can't remember if it was in New York and L.A., but they definitely did it in Nashville. And that worked, you know, that he has such a really, he's a great musician, his album is great, and he has a really interesting backstory as well. So that was something that was worth kind of doing this direct communication on.
Yeah, you
so
point
it's part
out.
Of, it's part, I beg your pardon. It's part of your business plan now. You go out on tour, you usually go to the local radio station, you hobnob with the DJs, you go meet with the local people running the clubs, and now maybe you go and hit up the Grammy voters. This is going to be part of the job that you do every time you're in a new town and city.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a distinction, I think, that probably should be mentioned between what happens in music and what happens in, say, movies or TV, which is that music is obviously not as centralized. So artists aren't always in the same city. You know, they aren't always in New York and L.A., whereas, you know, Hollywood is where the entire movie industry is. So it's really easy to have an event and have everybody come to the event and promote this particular film or this particular artist or actor. It's a little bit more difficult with music because those artists are traveling all around the country.
Is that why doing events and interviews at the Grammy Museum, which seems to be happening more and more with artists, is that why artists are doing that? So that, you know, they're recorded, they're on the Grammy websites, that people can see them. They're putting their face out there and saying, look, I'm a good guy. Look, I do all of this educational stuff. I'm with the Grammy Foundation. Is that one of the reasons for that?
Yeah, I mean, people, that's a little cynical for people to say out loud. You know, people don't say, hey, I'm working with kids for the Grammy Foundation because I won an award. You know, they don't really quite admit that. But yeah, that stuff all helps. You know, the Grammy Museum in LA, if, you know, I went through and looked at the calendar for the most recent couple of months during the voting period. And sure enough, it's like, who's on the list giving a prominent Q&A? Julia Michaels and a showcase of some kind, and, you know, Christine McVie and Lindsay Buckingham, and, you know, people who are probably going to be in the sweet spot of being up for a Grammy for next year. Is it effective? Sure, I think it's effective. I mean, if you're a Grammy voter in LA and you go to the Grammy Museum and you're charmed by an amazing act, yeah, you might vote for them more. It might be more likely. Sure.
You know, you talk about in your article, you say Portugal the Man. He started taking out full page ads in some major newspapers. Chance the Rapper said, you know, come on, that seems lame to campaign. And now he's like, I'm going to do this a lot. And so in the Oscars, you know, at some point it became so much campaigning, they tried to push back. And I feel like you're telling us that the Grammys, they're just getting going. They're just starting to sense the possibility of how they can promote themselves.
I think that yes and no. I mean, I think that the Grammys in the music business, things have changed a lot. I mean, I think, if we were to have the same interview 15, 20 years ago or earlier, I think that you would have found out, and I say this in the article, that, you know, publicists for record labels were sending, you know, the giant, rare, limited edition box set of CDs, you know, for Sting or whoever to Grammy voters, you know, and that was sort of like, don't forget, here's a really awesome thing. It's by Sting. He's up for a Grammy Award, you know, so that's what would have been happening then. And now things are different because there really aren't CDs. There are, but they're not as important. No, you know, people aren't going out and buying CDs. They don't value CDs as a thing that makes them vote. So now there's streaming and, you know, getting yourself in front of people using YouTube and more importance on live events. So things are changing. It's a little bit different than it was before. And I think that's kind of what's happening. We might be in sort of 1.0 of this for this new world.
Here's a 180 gram vinyl LP.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, physical stuff still does happen, but I imagine that there's many, many more Grammy voters than before who are not as swayed by getting goodies in the form of physical music.
Well, I see another book in your future then.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Let's talk to my agent together.
Well, in the meantime, thank you very much for taking the time to join us to talk about your piece in Rolling Stone. And we'll place a link to it in our show notes, and we'll place a link to your Twitter account, as well as links to your books, MJ, The Genius of Michael Jackson, and of course, Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Business in the Digital Age. Thank you very much.
Of course. Thanks, guys.
Well, I, for one, am very glad that Steve Knopper was able to join us to discuss his article in Rolling Stone about how musicians and artists are launching their own Grammy marketing campaigns. I found that article fascinating, and it's worth reading. I will place links to it in the show notes, but in an interest of trying to get at least one show in close to an hour, I think maybe we should move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the CBS series Elementary looked to be on its last legs. The show got renewed for a sixth season, but the network was only ordering 13 episodes from the Johnny Lee Miller reboot of Sherlock Holmes. But a funny thing happened on the way to nearing its finale. CBS canceled the poorly performing Jeremy Piven show Wisdom of the Crowd. It was on the bubble already, and a cloud of sexual misconduct over Jeremy Piven made their decision easier. Suddenly, they had a slot on Sunday to fill, and Elementary, My Dear Michael, saw its order jump from 13 to 21 episodes. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, but not for that reason. Buried in the story was the fact that, you know, they've made a lot of money on selling the show to streaming services. like Netflix, obviously, that the show's done really well there. It's sort of a semi-serialized show. You can watch any episode out of order, but you can enjoy it a little bit more if you binge watch and watch them in order. So it sort of works both ways in that case. And then there was one other little comment by CBS when they said they were renewing the show and boosting up the episode order. They said the show has, quote, solid international appeal, end quote. And to me, that's like the big elephant in the room of television. They make so much money on TV shows being sold worldwide, and we never hear a word about how much.
Well, we don't hear about how much. We do know that they're doing it because there are whole conventions and trade shows built around it.
But they don't like to talk about it. They don't boast about it. They don't say, oh, this show is huge. They don't say we're making this much money. This show grows this much. That show did that much. It's kind of like the days of DVDs when they were making more on DVD than they were at box office in the movie theater. They didn't say a word about it.
Don't you understand? All television shows lose money. You don't understand. Just ask any agent for talent that stars in TV shows. They know because they get the balance sheet where, of course, all the shows are in the red.
Well, I went to a club last night and danced for joy, and you can maybe explain why on our next piece.
Well, actually, here's one thing Mayor de Blasio has done that all New Yorkers can applaud. It's legal to dance again in the city, in New York City. No, the Big Apple wasn't like that small town in Footloose, not quite. But an archaic 91-year-old cabaret law did make it illegal to dance in small bars and restaurants. Only places with a cabaret license could permit dancing. While not strictly enforced, it kind of was, with many restaurants and bars that might have had a space for dancing choosing to play it safe. Now they can kick up their heels. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a big deal, actually. I mean, there's a lot of bars and restaurants that are very happy and excited by this. They're going to take advantage of it. I went out with a friend on Friday night or Saturday night, and he was like, what? Really? He goes, I can dance right here. I go, you can dance right there, right now? Yes, you can. It was like the end of Footloose. Very exciting.
Now, here's the funny thing. Guess where the bar Coyote Ugly is? It's in New York. And isn't that the bar where all those women were dancing on the bar?
Well, I think the original was in Nashville, wasn't it?
Oh, maybe.
But maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. Okay, Barnes & Noble, speaking of books, as we did earlier, they had a poor second quarter. Barnes & Noble, for those who are outside the country, big book retailer here in the United States. Revenue dropped for the retailer 8% and losses doubled to $40 million compared to the same quarter 1 year earlier. But Barnes & Noble has a new plan. Get this, Michael, and you're going to be bowled over by it. Their plan? Books.
What?
Yes. It's like The Graduate. Plastics. books. They're going to focus on books. The company has been aggressively clearing out any toys and games and stationery and the like that isn't selling. They plan on opening more stores than they close in 2018, and they want smaller stores with an emphasis on books. Yes, books. Genius idea. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a big whoop because every quarter they have a new plan, and that does not inspire confidence. It's going to be bigger stores. We're going to have more space for eating. We're going to sell beer and wine. We're going to sell more toys and notepaper and diaries. No, we're going to get rid of that stuff and sell more books. Every week it's a new idea. It's just shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Oh, okay. Well, the TV series American Gods needs some new gods of its own. The showrunners Brian Fuller and Michael Green are exiting the show. They wanted a bigger per-episode budget for a season two, but those penny pinchers at Fremantle said no. For season one, American Gods spent $10 million per episode. Per episode! Good grief, that's a lot of money. Big deal or big whoop.
I don't know how they do. We can barely get this show in under $11 million per episode.
Yeah, that's why we need your support.
Isn't that unbelievable? $10 million? I just can't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when The X-Files was like, people were rolling their eyes because it was $3 million an episode, and that was at the end of its run, and people were like, that's just way too much money for an episode of television.
Those were the days.
Yes. Speaking of those were the days, you know, the days when DVDs made money, Redbox is the omnipresent vendor that rents DVDs and Blu-rays via kiosks around the United States. Since they don't have a deal with Disney, Redbox buys Disney films like Pirates of the Caribbean when they come out on DVD, puts them in their kiosks, and then rents them, rather than getting a discount and access to titles before they hit stores. Now, Redbox is also selling digital download codes. You know, if you buy Coco when it comes out on Blu-ray, you'll probably get both a Blu-ray disc and a DVD disc, and a code to download a digital copy. Now, that code is marked not for resale, but Redbox says, pshaw. Disney says, oh, we'll see you in court. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because I think they'll settle before it gets to court. It makes no sense to me. There is a great court case to be made for having a right to resell your digital movie that you purchased, but this is not that case. Since you really buy three different ones and you're only selling off a third of it, it's just very complicated and confusing. It seems hard to argue.
Yes, no, this is one Redbox will lose. Okay, this is definitely not one they will win, and I agree with you. There is,
but if you have the right to buy, if you buy the Blu-ray and DVD, do you not have the right to resell just the DVD? Yes. Do you have the right to resell just the Blu-ray? Yes, you do. But so then why not the digital one? I don't know why I resist this idea, but I do.
Yeah, I think there's something with this particular case. I have a feeling they're going to say, no, that code goes with the DVD. So, or goes with the Blu-ray, meaning you can't, you know, separate them and sell them separately.
But you can sell the DVD and the Blu-ray separately.
Yes, and that's because it's a physical copy. As you say, Michael, this is not the case.
It's too confused.
Correct. Yes. Now, ever since Jimmy Fallon playfully interviewed Donald Trump during the presidential election, he's paid a price. Cozying up to fascist hate mongers apparently doesn't pay well in late night TV. The price he's paid has continued to grow. In February, a revitalized Stephen Colbert took the lead in late night here in the United States, at least among total viewers. Worse for Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel has grown by leaps and bounds in ratings and good press with his passionate support of healthcare for all after his own son's medical crisis. Colbert is now averaging 3.5 million viewers in late night, with Fallon almost 1 million viewers behind at 2.6 million. Kimmel is right behind at 2.4 million. Fallon is the youngest late night host and has the lead in the 18 to 49 demo, but they've all lost viewers in that demo, and Fallon has lost the most. His lead is tiny even there. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I shouldn't say this because we've seen things change much more quickly in morning TV, and we may again. But typically in late night, things change very slowly. And when they change, they stay changed for a while. That's what we've been used to historically. Maybe that's not happening anymore. But it's certainly bad news for NBC and Jimmy Fallon. And when they're trying to figure it out what to do, I think, by the way, the last, they don't know what to do. They're scared. They're giving interviews to the New York Times. He's depressed. He's like, oh, I didn't mean to. I'm a nice guy. And the last thing they should do is try to get political or pretend to be something he's not. He's an affable, nice guy. They should indeed continue to do that. He just shouldn't have jerks on the show. You know, don't let them on your show in the first place, because you should not be a nice guy to someone everyone thinks is a jerk. That's, I think, the lesson to be learned. You're not a show where people can be dealt with that need to be challenged. That's not your wheelhouse. So just don't let them on in the first place.
Well, and in that regard, what I would say, last year during the run up to the election, he had already had, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be wrong about this, Hillary Clinton was on or was going to be on.
Doesn't matter.
There's an equal time rule.
That went out years ago. Are you kidding me? There's no equal time and fair thing, whatever. No, there isn't. Well, it just doesn't come into play. It's not possible.
I think the equal time rule, though, is you have to offer it. It doesn't mean you have to provide it. You know, and sorry, you have to provide it and offer it. Doesn't mean you actually, they can turn it down. You know, in other words, the other party can say.
I don't believe that. That may be for the network. It's not for that particular show. That equal time rule, with the way television works these days, it doesn't seem possible. You know, I don't think that fits the late night television. I don't think it applies.
Well, it certainly doesn't apply to news channels anymore. That's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's just out the window. So I don't think he was forced to. He obviously was not forced to take Trump. He chose to, and it wasn't because he had Hillary on. He wanted him on, and he wanted to play with him. That was his choice. If he wants to refuse to have him on and let Trump sue him and say, "I want equal time," you know, that would be a whole different kettle of fish.
Well, Trump would have sued the network, not.
Right. It wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. Director Bryan Singer is directing the new musical about Queen. It's called Bohemian Rhapsody, after the song by Queen. Well, he's sort of directing it. Singer never showed up after the Thanksgiving break. The studio finally shut down production and vaguely claimed Singer had to deal with some sort of family medical issue. In fact, Singer has routinely shown up late on the set, with a cinematographer having to step in and direct when Singer was a no-show. Singer also disappeared briefly during the filming of X-Men Apocalypse and Superman Returns. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I'm just gobsmacked by this story.
It's a gobsmack.
It's a gobsmack. In the story, they say the producers are nervous and they're reportedly discussing replacing him on the film, which stars Rami Malek and is set for Christmas Day of 2018. I'm just like, really? He just doesn't. He shows up late. Even that blows my mind. Like, you're the director. Nothing can happen until you're there and say action. What do you think? Like, you have to be there. It's not an option. It's like us doing the show and just not showing up. It wouldn't work. It's just, and I can't believe he's done it on previous movies and people knew about this. And my mind is blown by this. It's like, you're the star of the movie. You can't just not show up. You've got to be there. But the director, you have to say action. Nothing happens until you say action. That's just insane to me. But anyway, who knew?
Well, not only that, but one of the things many directors will tell you, at least motion picture directors, is that the number of decisions you have to make before you even hit the set on a given day, from arriving at the set to walking to the director's chair, is remarkable.
A gazillion. Of course. Yeah. You've got, you're the guy. You're the only person who can make all those decisions and choices and make things happen. It's all about you. It's just, that's just totally weird. Yeah.
And Channing Tatum said, when asked about Steven Soderbergh, about why would he want to retire? And he said, I think he was just tired of, constantly having to answer questions, constantly having to say, people say, well, what color should this be? And what color should that be? And, do we put the mug of coffee here or over here? He was just like, I don't want to answer anybody else's questions.
Well, he wasn't that tired because he's still doing it.
Well, right. Exactly. Well, you know what I am tired of? I'm actually tired of having to talk about sexual misconduct, which is the subject for Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And let's face it, Michael, I'm not the only one that is tired of talking about this subject. In fact, here is a little clip from Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update from Saturday.
Oh, and I almost forgot about this week's batch of predators. It's just a whole segment of the news now. I just got to announce the names every week like Powerball numbers.
Yeah, no, that's actually kind of funny. Maybe I should watch Saturday Night Live again. Yes, that's how it feels here sometime. Just a bullet points of Powerball numbers like 14, 17, 24, which are not Powerball numbers, but the ages of people who've been sexually harassed, assaulted, and raped. Hilarious. Anyway, yes, there's a whole new bevy of people, including Matt Lauer and James Levine and other people. It's kind of upsetting. But I felt like it was put into context pretty well by a New York Times op-ed. They pointed out that a number of the men who covered Hillary Clinton's election campaign for the White House and did so rather negatively, and people were noting it at the time, have come out to be caught up in this sexual misconduct scandal where Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, Mark Halperin, and Glenn Thrush of the New York Times have all been caught up in this to one degree or another. And it's kind of interesting to point out some of the people who led the way in giving her very negative press coverage have themselves been found to be questionable at best in their behavior.
Right. And we should point out Matt Lauer was the host of one of the top watched morning shows. He was with NBC News. Glenn Thrush was with The New York Times. Charlie Rose was with CBS News. And Mark Halperin, I think, was with NBC News as well.
Among other things, yeah, and a writer and a published books and things like that.
So all of these people. Now, Matt Lauer was kind of a surprise, at least to the public, on Wednesday when all of a sudden he was fired by NBC News.
That's right. They got wind that the New York Times, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, a lot of media outlets were circling Matt Lauer, who I didn't know this, but apparently people have known for years he's been sleeping around, which is not necessarily unethical or has anything to do with his job. But now they were circling around stories that he was, in fact, engaging in sexual misconduct. And they got a lot of people on the record, a lot of stories. And NBC tried to get ahead of that by suspending him. And then, boom, a minute later, he was fired.
Yes. And it happened very, very quickly, which, again, we should point out, this is one of NBC's big cash cows, this morning show.
Oh my God, the Today Show, the first 2 hours generate $500 million a year. That's how valuable he is to the company. And that's why he's been able to get away with it for all these years.
It seemed to come as a shock to those, his co-hosts, especially Al Roker, who is the weatherman kind of host. And I thought the way that they handled it, they should have cut the commercial after they introed, after they did their intro, they should have just cut the commercial and then come back for Al Roker. But it was very awkward.
Well, okay. That's a difficult day when you're writing a story about your friend or somebody you work with for many years, obviously. But yeah, when you work beside people, you don't let them see the darker, uglier side of you necessarily. Megyn Kelly said, hey, I heard rumors about Mal Lauer, but then I've heard rumors about myself that were completely untrue. Said, I heard about Charlie Rose. And, you know, again, we're not trying to cut anyone's slack, but it is important to remember these really visible people see lies about themselves all the time in like newspaper tabloids and the grocery stores and online on TMZ. So you go, wow, they knew, they've heard. It's like, well, maybe they heard, but they probably didn't think it was true.
Right. That's why a lot of people are saying, we don't think, you know, we never heard rumors about Al Franken.
That's true. But more women have come forward, unfortunately. So in our laundry list of people this week, there is Mal Lauer. There is Russell Simmons, the music industry mogul, who's also been a really important role model for a lot of people. He's been a terrific figure, which makes the fact that he has been found alleged sexual misconduct and has felt the need to step down from all his businesses and foundations. That's really upsetting to a major community, both music and the people of color community. Al Franken, more women have come forward, though none of them have been in a business context. None of them have been women where he's been demanding sexual favors in exchange for advancing their career. They've all been in the context of photo shoots and in the public arena where he's kissing someone on stage or is doing a meet and greet and puts his hand on them. That's not to excuse it, but at least the allegations are at that level. For the moment, he still has his job.
Yes. And then playwright Israel Horovitz, a name not a lot of people might know, although he is the father of Adam Horovitz. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because he is Ad-Rock of the Beastie Boys.
That's right. He wrote a really small play called The Line about people standing in line. And it ran for 10,000 years off Broadway. So he's kind of a well-known figure and he's written other plays of note. But he's had 9 women come forward accusing him of sexual misconduct going back decades. And the kind of upsetting or sad thing here is that Ad-Rock was asked about it. He said, yeah, I believe the women.
Yeah.
And Israel has apologized to his family and to the women and says, of course, his memory is different, but he apologizes. But that's just the tip of the iceberg for Broadway and the theater community. A casting director has been fired from his job. And this guy worked on Newsies, The Color Purple, Kinky Boots. His name is, so he's a big name in the theater community, Justin Huff. He's a young guy. And we've been hearing rumors for a while now from multiple people I have about stories being written about the Broadway world and sexual misconduct in that world. We had Kevin Spacey in London. There is probably a lot more to come. And that certainly has already happened at the Metropolitan Opera.
Yeah, the Metropolitan Opera in New York, James Levine was the music director there for decades. And he's the music director and conductor at numerous symphonies and orchestras around the world and has been over the decades. And I guess he was accused of sexual, I guess it's abuse when you're under the age of 18, right?
It depends on the person and the context. I mean, people can be of consent. It depends on the state and the country that you're in. But he's been accused of sexual misconduct with someone as young as 15 years old. That person came to the police in 2016 to file a report. They are investigating it. This is not the first person. Now, 2 more people have come forward of him abusing his power and his position as a conductor, starting back when he was in his 20s and becoming a superstar. These stories apparently have surfaced for decades. He addressed them, vague rumors of misconduct, in the New York Times back in 1987. Somebody wrote about it in their biography about working at the Met, published in 2001. When you wonder why people don't come forward, part of it is that people do come forward and nothing happens and they feel there's no point and they're the only ones who are going to pay a price. So it is very upsetting to me because I love James Levine. I go to the opera. I see his little nimbus of hair glowing when he gets up there in front of the symphony about to conduct. And it's just one of the warmest, happiest images I have is being in the dark and seeing his head lit up from behind and getting ready to conduct and lead the orchestra in a symphony in an opera. And so it's really upsetting when somebody you kind of really like and appreciate has perhaps behaved very poorly in his personal life. And professional life, I should say.
You know, actually, if you really want to know how these incidents and these assaults and harassment affects people, read the New York Times story, because at the end of it, the person, and this was, you know, it happened in 1969, and yet it still affected one of the people that said, you know, James Levine basically harassed him sexually during when he was a teenager. And it was a very, I mean, he quit music. It was a very telling.
Yeah, he cried. He couldn't get through the interview. He was crying. And he said, I don't know why it's so upsetting, but it's something about, I'm paraphrasing, the abuse of power or just the loss of innocence and just the feeling of being cheapened. And, you know, it still is, upsets him to this day and has created problems all his life. And he even says, I you know, James, you know, he describes what happened. It was not that he was put in a torture chamber, but it was an abuse of trust and confidence. I mean, James Levine met this guy first when he was 4 years old. And then at 15, he approached him sexually. So that can obviously be confusing. Someone you've known your entire life suddenly does that. That is very confusing. And it obviously has upset him greatly. So it's very upsetting to hear about other people. Like, you know, he puts him in a position of power in an orchestra, lets them be first cello. I'm forgetting the instrument. And then when he won't reciprocate sexually, he dumps him.
Right.
You know, so, and that drives you. It cheapens everything. You know, something you love becomes something cheap and hateful. So you can talk about, oh, this guy was 17, but you're abusing your position of power and you're playing with people's lives and you're doing something that's unprofessional, even if you don't think, even if it's not illegal, it's unprofessional and inappropriate. And that's why people in power shouldn't do it. So it's very upsetting. Garrison Keillor has some charges against him. Jeffrey Rush, both of them are isolated single persons. They deny them in various complicated ways. They are not, we don't even know what Jeffrey Rush is being accused of, and neither does he. And Garrison Keillor, again, is one person. He says, well, it's more complicated than that. He describes it. It sounds very reasonable.
Yeah, and Garrison Keillor, for those who don't know, is a, you know, he is the creator, and he was the host of A Prairie Home Companion on National Public Radio for decades. He also did a daily poetry reading for Minnesota Public Radio, which was syndicated here in the U.S. And, you know, there were a lot of people that didn't like A Prairie Home Companion, and it had its...
Oh, it's lovely.
Yeah, and then it had its advocate followers. And this came out, he kind of was the one who mentioned it in an Associated Press interview that he had been fired by Minnesota Public Radio because of, you know, inappropriate behavior. And he went on to say, look, you know what? I was consoling someone who said they were unhappy. I put my hand on her back. Her back happened to be bare. My hand slipped. She recoiled. I immediately apologized. I sent her an email later that day, that night, saying, again, I apologize. And she said, look, don't even think about it. And we were friends for a long time afterwards, right up until I heard from her lawyer.
Well, the thing I had to smile about was when he said, I am the least physically affectionate person on the planet. You go, oh, you know, actually, at the end of Prairie Home Companion, you would see the cast members all hugging. And he said, I would stand off to the edge of the stage like an iceberg. Like, yeah, I was not the one that wanted to hug at the end of every show. That's kind of funny. One doesn't want to make light of what she says. But all these people now are all linked together. People like Matt Lauer, where you have descriptions of really nasty, hateful, unpleasant behavior, and James Levine, the same thing, to people like Garrison Keillor and Jeffrey Rush, where we barely know what happened, and it's only one person, and we don't know what credence to give it. Now they're all linked together in varying levels of misery, including Bill O'Reilly, who is now being sued by a Fox News producer. She's suing him for defamation of character because she left her job. She said she was forced out by his behavior. They had to give her money in a settlement because of his misbehavior and misconduct. And part of that was a non-disparagement clause. And she said he has blown that by going public and saying that these people are just going after the money and they were lying. And she said, well, guess what? You're the one who's a liar. And now she's suing him in federal court.
Proving him right. So,
yeah, so there's a lot more to go with all of these people. The big problem is when you get defended by Geralda.
Yeah, I guess he said that journalism is a flirty business. So I had no idea. I'm now going to change the way I conduct interviews. So I will also be interviewing more women. Michael, you're going to be interviewing more men. And yeah, we're good now. Geraldo told us what we could do.
He also said, perhaps we're criminalizing courtship.
Yes, apparently. That's what we're doing.
And some of these women want is money. And by the way, his biography written many years ago was called Exposing Myself.
Yeah. Whoops. Yeah.
Well, golly, I think that wraps up sexual misconduct for the day, don't you?
Oh, I see what you're doing. You're moving us along into obituaries. And the reason you said golly is because Jim Nabors died, and he was always known as Gomer Pyle. from the Andy Griffith Show. I mean, that was one of those characters that just stuck with me. Was he able to get past that, really? I don't know.
Not as an actor, and he said he wasn't much of an actor, and he was surprised he had any success. So he was very grateful for Andy Griffith's show, and then Gomer Pyle USMC, which was his own show. But, you know, he was on the Carol Burnett Show for many years. He was a sort of her lucky charm. She would always have him on as the first guest of the season. And by the way, Carol Burnett just had a special on CBS Sunday night, a big success in the ratings because people love Carol Burnett. But he's an interesting guy. He had a nice singing voice, not a great singer, but he had a nice voice. And he always opened up the Indy 500 by singing Back Home in Indiana, did that for decades, even after coming out. He came out of the closet a few years ago, which is great for him. This is a guy who's beloved by the heartland, so it really means something when someone like that comes out. He was friends with Rock Hudson for many years. They were just friends, but people got it in their heads that these two were lovers and had gotten married, and it happened because there was a party. Every year they'd have a party, Rock Hudson and his friends, including Gomer Pyle, Jim Nabors. And one of them wrote a joke saying, for that year's party, come watch Rock Hudson and Gomer Pyle get married. Rock's new name will be Rock Pyle. It was clearly a joke. And of course, it's not even Jim Nabors' name. It's Gomer Pyle. It's not even a real person's name. But after that, people were like, they got married. Oh my God, Jim Nabors and Rock Hudson got married. And they actually never like hang around again and spoke to each other again because it was too dangerous. But he lived long enough to marry his partner of decades in Washington, D.C. in 2013. So that's kind of cool. And, you know, it just shows you how powerful a hit sitcom can be that decades later, I walked by a record store and it said, golly, Jim Nabors, Mort.
Right. So, again, they were conflating two languages. French and right. English, whereas we just conflate one, English. And in fact, if you want to hear us conflate it every week, you should subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. And please do, as Michael mentioned at the top of the show, rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. Links to those ways to subscribe to us, ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can call us 888-567-SAN. That's 888-567-7263. Again, all of this information on showbizsandbox.com. Follow us on Twitter @showbizsandbox. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's amymannisnotafolksinger.com.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. I guess you can find out like the four books that are being published this week over at Bookfilter. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.